Linda, thank you. And our last speaker, it's a great pleasure to introduce Ralph Pentland. He's really, with Jim Bruce, the two sort of architects of the of what one could say is among the heydays of federal engagement on water issues. He is the acting chair of the Canadian Water Issues Council, president of the Broward Enterprises Incorporated. He was a longstanding director of water planning management at Environment Canada before it was called Environment Canada. And he is the principal author of the federal water policy, which was tabled to Parliament in 1987. Ralph, it's a great pleasure to welcome you.
Thank you very much, Scott. I'd also like to thank the organizers of the conference. I personally learned a lot in the last couple of days. What I'd like to do is something a little different. I'd like to explore three concepts that seem to be good ideas at the time they were introduced, but may not be such good ideas now, or may need a little bit of recalibration. Those three concepts are sustainable development, so-called smart regulation, and theories about managing in an information age. Those seem to be different topics, but in my mind, they're three closely related parts of the pieces of the same puzzle. So let me start with the sustainable development. In 1987, the Brundtland Commission published its landmark document, Our Common Future. I just read that the other day again. The entire report was based on the assumption that humanity has the ability to make development sustainable, to ensure that it meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their needs. That clearly implies limits of some sort. But what made the Brundtland concept different from previous theories of growth like the Club of Rome and so on was the added assumption that the limits themselves could be expanded through improved technology and social organization. In other words, the biosphere could absorb ever-increasing volumes of human activity through technological and institutional advances. And in fact, we can advance limits to some degree, expand limits. For example, with respect to water, we traditionally expanded limits by building dams, drilling wells. And as that potential diminished, we started to expand limits by raising productivity, increasing efficiencies, and managing waste better. There's also potential to expand limits by taking advantage of synergies between sectors. If we save water, we save energy. You've heard it before. If you save energy, you save water. But sustainable development infers that we'll never allow the level of economic activity to exceed the carrying capacity of a region or the globe, for that matter. Of course, everything is ultimately self-correcting. If ecological carrying capacity is exceeded, the level of economic activity will necessarily be jolted downward at some point through conflicts, price shocks, or other catastrophic events. We just witnessed one in a way that an energy price shock 3 years ago exposed an unregulated derivatives market which almost brought down the world's financial system. Just imagine if you had an energy shock and a food price shock at the same time about 10 years from now. In that sense, it can be argued that we're already heading down several unsustainable paths. Early in the 21st century, the pattern of human conflict is being fundamentally reshaped by uneven population growth, consequent migration pressures, geopolitical tensions linked to energy insecurity, widespread regional water shortages, and irreversible climate change. Why are we on several unsustainable paths a quarter century after the world community agreed on the concept of sustainable development? I'm just going to give you two possibilities, and I'm sure you have others, but one would be that a lot of people have used the expanded limits idea as a license to simply unfettered development on the mistaken assumption that advancing technology would automatically overcome all forms of resource scarcity. A second and more fundamental reason is the fact that as the economy globalized, decision-making moved both downward and upward at the same time. It drifted downward by simply downloading responsibilities to often ill-equipped local entities and at the same time hollowing out critical senior government capacity, and I'll come back to that. Unfortunately, above national governments, there are no democratic institutions. So as governance drifted upward, it drifted upward to a combination of multinational corporations and non-democratic entities like the IMF and the WTO. All of these entities tend to place a higher priority on short-term investor protection than they do on sustaining long-term public good. We heard about fiduciary duty this morning. A corporation has a fiduciary duty to its shareholders, And a government has a fiduciary duty to citizens. We've tended to blur that quite a bit. And governments now, I think, have a fiduciary duty, or think they have a fiduciary duty to shareholders, and often international shareholders. There's no doubt that sustainable development started out as a good idea, but sustainable development as it has evolved on the global and national scales has become a very risky proposition. I don't have time to go into the litany of global water woes, but I'll just mention two that I find particularly disturbing. One, there are now several hundred million people who depend on food grown with underground water that's not being replaced. And the second one is emerging research on environment health linkages. There was a recent report just a couple of weeks ago to the U.S. Congressional Committee on the latest research worldwide on this topic, and I found some of it quite scary, actually. Canada is, of course, in a better off than most other countries because of our relatively sparse population and generous endowment of resources. But the economic and environmental trends here are equally troublesome. In a recent article in the Globe and Mail, the recently retired clerk of the Privy Council commented on our economic trends as follows. Quote, Canadians have been trapped in a beguiling productivity trap for almost a generation. We work harder and harder, use up our resources faster and faster, while the trap keeps us less rich, less able to provide public goods, and less competitive. And more specifically related to water, according to recent polls that you've heard about in the last day or two, most Canadians think water is their most important resource, and 75% of them are concerned about the long-term supply and quality, and for very good reason. So the basic question, is sustainability even possible without crisis? And I think the jury's still out on that. Despite wishful thinking, sustainable development can't and will not be achieved by the invisible hand of the international marketplace alone. But the efficiencies of the free market are going to have to be a necessary part of the solution. So what we are going to need, and this is where the question mark comes in, we're going to need a major augmentation of science, policy, and regulatory capacities within governments, especially national governments, so that they can continually redefine the public policy space and incentive systems within which the efficiencies of the free market can most effectively be redirected to the goal of sustainability. Now I'd like to move to regulatory trends for a minute. As trade agreements were signed and the international competitiveness agenda took hold in the late 1980s, there are enormous pressures on governments to make regulation more efficient and more effective. That's across the board, not just environment, it's food safety, transportation, a whole range of things. In and of itself, that was a laudable goal with which none of us would disagree. But as we moved through the 1990s, the competitiveness agenda moved us from regulatory efficiency to minimalist regulation across all sectors. Elaborate analytical and procedural requirements were put in place, making the adoption of new regulations very difficult. There was also a strong reliance on affected economic interests to regulate the impacts of their own activities on the environment and public health and safety. More recently, based mainly on the advice of the business community, the Canadian government formally adopted what they termed SMART regulation. I think SMART has S-M-A-R-T, stands for five things, but... Anyway, so-called SMART regulation includes many of the characteristics of the minimalist approach while adding the idea of promoting the interests of regulated entities as explicit goals of regulatory activities. The idea of making regulation more efficient and effective was fine, and we have in fact made a lot of progress in that regard. But in my view, we went way overboard in blurring the distinction between the regulators and the regulated. A recent book by Bruce Scott from Harvard University entitled The Concept of Capitalism questions the idea that capitalism can be just a one-level system governed by markets. He stresses, using sports analogies, that the freedom to compete must necessarily be conditional on playing by the rules and points to the need for three strong and independent levels of governance: rule makers, rule enforcers, and game players. In recent years, we have somewhat compromised the roles, the capacity, and the independence of rulemakers and rule enforcers. And as a result, it could be credibly argued that both democracy and capitalism have been at least somewhat diminished. Unfortunately, things have probably progressed too far to simply go back and correct our mistakes. At this juncture, we'll likely need more comprehensive regulatory reforms which explicitly recognize that certain natural resources, especially air, fresh water, and oceans, are central to our very existence. For that reason, governments will eventually have to accept that they have a continuing fiduciary duty to sustain the essence of those resources into perpetuity for the use and enjoyment of the entire population, somewhat akin to the public trust laws that they have in every state south of the border. Sustainable development and more efficient regulation are both examples of good ideas in need of recalibration. I'd like to touch on just one more. About the same time as sustainable development was touted as the way to overcome limits to growth, new theories also emerged about managing in an information age. Most of those theories suggested that the balancing of social, economic, and environmental interests should take place in an integrated way at a relatively local level, in the case of water and related resources, mostly at a watershed level. Senior governments would no longer try to impose all manner of sector-specific local solutions, but they would ensure a sufficient national knowledge capacity and exercise leadership in synthesizing, interpreting, and disseminating useful and appropriate information. They would also provide local entities with clear policy and regulatory frameworks that would ensure the wider interests of society were respected. In return, citizens, broadly defined, would make responsible decisions and take responsible actions. Good theory. Unfortunately, the theory remains largely untested. First, because subsequent reductions in national science capacity and increasingly risk-averse public services made knowledge less rather than more readily available to citizens. Second, because international pressures aimed at removing impediments to international competitiveness made rulemaking and enforcement both less transparent and less predictable. And third, because we lost many of the public participation opportunities that were open to citizens under a plethora of intergovernmental arrangements in previous decades. So what are the implications of these trends for water policy and water governance? From time to time, I hear someone say that the 1987 federal water policy is still mostly relevant, and all it needs is a bit of updating, a little fine-tuning. I don't think it's that simple. The world and Canada's place in that world is very different than they were when we wrote the 87 policy. Water sector managers have since been overwhelmed by forces outside the sector and outside the country, and the hollowing out of national environmental science and policy capacity. We do need water policy reform to strengthen and better integrate top-down knowledge and policies with bottom-up decision-making and action. But that reform needs to be to at least recognize and hopefully contribute to broader public policy reforms beyond just the water sector. For that and other reasons, meaningful water policy reform may be a little ways off yet. In the meantime, water managers at a river basin or local level are left with a dilemma. They're struggling with difficult issues, many of which extend beyond their regions, often without the scientific, policy, regulatory, and financial support that they need and probably should be expecting from their more senior governments. I find it interesting, I've heard it a couple times today too, that local water managers across Canada are more and more often using the term water security rather than sustainability. I suspect that's because it's a fallback position. Because security seems more tangible, objective than sustainability, given the fact that transient adaptation to largely uncontrollable forces is rapidly becoming the essence of local water management. What can water managers do, at the level of a river basin, when they're faced with unpredictable and largely uncontrollable things like climate change, exponentially accelerating non-renewable resource extraction, and a growing array of health-threatening pollutants? And at best, uncertain top-down governance. I would suggest that what they should do is hope for the best but plan for the worst. What they can do is focus on maximizing the resilience of local ecosystems to cope with the unknown and the uncontrollable by dealing as effectively as they can with what is known and what is within their control. The most obvious candidates are, of course, keeping water within its natural watershed boundaries, treating it with respect, it and its watersheds with respect, and using it as efficiently as possible. Thank you.